So a little program note for you. We'll be here for you Monday night, Memorial Day, with some special programming. So make sure you're part of that. When we come back with Linda Moulton Howe in a moment, we'll find out about hundreds of leopard sharks found dead. What the heck is going on there? That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And here we are, and Linda continues with another part of her investigation. What is it this time, Linda?
Well, George, are you getting the feeling that there's just one environmental crisis after another anymore?
It's like pieces of a puzzle, isn't it?
Yeah, and that they're coming together faster and faster, and there's one up in San Francisco Bay that really is baffling because the victim, if you want to put it that way, to whatever this mysterious cause is the leopard shark, which is famous for being such a rigorous, strong, it's a bottom feeder, doesn't hurt people, beautiful, can live 40 years, grow up to 5 feet, and, you know, not something that you expect, to suddenly being washing up on beaches around Redwood City, Foster City, Coyote Point, and Richardson's Bay, north of Sausalito. But going back at least to the 1st of April, that is the pattern that the California Fish and Game Department and the Pelagic Shark Research Foundation, based in Santa Cruz and Capitola, California, they started getting phone calls about dead leopard sharks washed up on beaches. And as reports increased, there seemed to be a pattern of the most deaths starting in the San Francisco Bay town of Redwood City area, and then spreading out to Foster City, and then to Coyote Point, and then to Richardson Bay. The California Department of Fish and Game Toxicology Lab has done some necropsies on the shark bodies and discovered hemorrhaging around the internal organs and inflammation and lesions in the leopard shark brains. But so far, no one understands what is killing these sharks. Leopard sharks have been around in the San Francisco Bay area for so long. Anyone there has seen them in the water because they like shallow water, and they will stay down in shallow water and go down, and they're what are called bottom feeders, mm-hmm. and they like to eat crabs, shrimp, bony fish, clams, and fish eggs. And it's harmless to humans, leopard sharks. But humans think that leopard shark meat is excellent eating, and the shark is hunted and sold fresh or frozen. The leopard shark is mostly fished in the waters off California, where in the 1980s there was a population decline, but the state came in and put in some fishing regulations, and in the 90s the population was back up, and they thought very sustainable in levels. But leopard sharks living alongside human development, such as the San Francisco Bay communities, can accumulate pollutants such as mercury, pesticides, and those polychlorinated biphenyls known as PCBs, and they take all that stuff and it sticks around in the shark body. And that's why the California Department of Fish and Game warns humans not to eat leopard shark on a regular basis. And now the irony is, could it be some new human industrial chemical, some runoff, some poison that's going into the water that is making the leopard shark sick or weakening its immune system so it's vulnerable to still unidentified pathogens or some other cause still unknown? Well, even though the first documented case of the washed-up dead shark was in mid-April, and you can see a lot of photographs that were taken by the Pelagic Shark Research Foundation at earthfiles.com that will give you a very good sense of the sadness and the tragedy of this die-off. Sean Van Summeren, he's the executive director of the Pelagic Shark Research Foundation, and he says that his office received calls about dead leopard sharks even before the 1st of April. So he thinks that this ongoing die-off of the shark started back near the beginning of this year. Here now is Sean Van Summeren.
We've gotten calls every single day for the last 5 months. We got a call from the Coast Guard about Redwood City having some wildlife issue and concern. So we had contact with a local resident and put them in contact with our stranding coordinator, Brandy Faulkner, out of Palo Alto, who responded. There were sharks, and they were dead. And then about a week later, it's still ongoing, and in fact, escalating, and then the count is up, you know, to maybe, you know, 50 animals in this just one canal and lagoon. And then dead things begin to appear nearby Foster City on their beaches. And then subsequent to that, by week two, animals off of Coyote Point, both distressed and dead, not as concentrated as in the Redwood City area, but exhibiting similar symptoms. You know, nothing, again, to indicate a spill, but definite impacts on the animals behaving distressed, swimming upside down. By then, Fish and Game had finally responded. The initial effort to respond was kind of curtailed abruptly by the existing, you know, budget constraints. There's a travel ban, in fact. And so we kind of went on with the investigations where we would secure specimens on site and then ship them to the lab in Southern California. It could be a number of different events happening separately, or it could be this, whatever it was that happened in Redwood City, you know, being released from there. And then it seems to go from there to Foster City to Coyote Point, and then Richardson Bay on the other side, Marin on the North Bay. And that's been the focus of it over the past 2 weeks. Not as concentrated as Redwood City, more scattered out, but the same, you know, symptoms and results, that being dead sharks on the beach. Initially, it involved bat rays as well, but as it moved beyond Foster City, we haven't seen any bat rays, just leopard sharks. And so we're trying to figure out why just leopard sharks. Leopard sharks are typically the last things to get that kind of infection. They're very tolerant to various, you know, salinity levels and temperatures and low oxygen and all that stuff that, you know, estuarine sharks need to cope with. And this is just hitting them really abruptly. They're not emaciated. They're just fully healthy animals that within apparently within a very brief period of time get infected, become immobilized, and just kind of, for lack of a better term, short circuits all their nerves. As well, internal organs begin to hemorrhage. So it's weird.
Well, yes, and since mid-April, and we're speaking in the middle of May, a month later, what is the total number of dead leopard sharks that you have?
No one really knows. I think the best way to sum it up is that it's an unknown number estimated to be in the hundreds, at least.
And a leopard shark, by definition, is a bottom feeder. Do you have any hypothesis about what the contamination could be that would be causing internal hemorrhaging in such a strong kind of marine creature as a leopard shark?
Good question. I got all kinds of, you know, intriguing guesses, but, you know, it's just speculation. I don't know. They are the kind of archetypal Californian estuarine coastal shark. They're kind of a signature species for San Francisco Bay. Leopard sharks often seen, still seen, finning in the shallow waters. And now they're just coming ashore dead and freaked out, contaminated with something.
Hundreds of leopard sharks is a significant die-off. Do you or anyone have a specific speculation about what the contamination might be if they are under necropsy showing hemorrhaging inside?
No. We know that it's affecting all the different generational categories, including young of the year, which is dreadful, and as well, heavy class adult, you know, females, some of them, you know, 5 feet long, which could be 30, 40 years old or more.
Wow.
And so those are big investments that we're losing in terms of, you know, the whole population. Possibly, and, you know, the internal hemorrhaging, again, the speculations run from rat poisoning to selenium and pesticides and methyl mercuries and all that stuff. And it, no one knows. It, you know, I'm hoping it's just water pollution, pathogens. It could be a bacterium. It could be, you know, some necrotizing protozoa.
But has anything like this ever happened before in these numbers?
Only in relation to spill events, which is alarming. Right now, it's an unknown number of animals estimated to be in the hundreds. That's just what we're seeing on the beaches. We have no idea what's going on, you know, in the murky water, in the deep waters, whether it's sediment contamination. I think, you know, that there's dietary differences between the generational categories, and it seems to be affecting all different generations. So I don't know that it's a food intake thing. You know, it could also be coming from urban runoff, you know, compounding stagnant water issues with landscaping products and everything from bug killer and cat litter to hand sanitizers and pharmaceuticals and all this stuff that runs into the watershed coming from agricultural and industrial. And, you know, the internal hemorrhaging definitely kind of leads one away from the notion that it is just a simple water pollution issue.
Isn't the fact that the leopard shark is a bottom feeder guide all of you to looking at what could be down on the floor that wasn't there before April that could be killing these sharks?
We got, you know, some pathologists working on it here on site now, and he's looked at 9 fresh live specimens. It's still an ongoing investigation. Animals were reported over the weekend. They were all leopard sharks, mostly dead, including animals washing up on the Baker Beach. This is an unprecedented event in terms of numbers and scope of strandings, and this is something new. So the search for a benign, meaningless cause to this event is not going to work. The one thing we do know is that the sharks are washing up dead in record numbers. There's a number of different specific tests that have to be done that cost a lot of money. Unfortunately, the event is still ongoing, so we're still gathering samples, and we really need the public's assistance to locate dead animals for the purposes of mapping it out around the bay, as well as securing these hard-to-get live, fresh specimens that can be analyzed by the veterinarians.
And, George, jeez. I talked with Van Sameren yesterday, and he said that they were still getting reports. They are still going out and gathering these leopard sharks. So this has been going on for some time, and it may be tapering off, which is confusing also, he said, because they still don't have a bottom line answer to what the problem could be. But I want to give out the contact information for the Pelagic Shark Research Foundation. We probably have a lot of coast listeners in that San Francisco, Redwood City, Tiburon, in that area. And at the bottom of my earthfiles.com report tonight, that is, when you go to the top of the headlines page, you will find this story about the shark die-off. And at the bottom of my report, I have their email addresses, where they are docked. They have a ship in the Santa Cruz Yacht Harbor. They also have a postal address in Capitola, California. But for simplicity, tonight on the air for Coast, I'm going to give out a phone number for anybody listening who may have any information or may want to get in touch with the Pelagic Foundation to help. And that phone number is area code 831-459-9346. Again, the Pelagic Shark Research Foundation. The phone number is 831-459-9346. And if you go to myearthfiles.com news report, there are a lot of photographs. He sent me approximately 40-some photos of the sharks in a whole variety of locations and a whole lot of conditions in which they were found, and a couple of those bat rays that were also found in the Redwood City, Foster City area. But for some reason, only about a half a dozen of those turned up. It has been the leopard shark and the leopard shark only. And what is very interesting in this whole story was one of the eyewitnesses to going and seeing a shark and calling it in lives in the East Bay, and told a reporter that she observed a kind of shriveled-looking adult leopard shark. It was just south of the San Francisco airport, and this was just about 8 days or 9 days ago in the middle of May. And said that the animal's remains looked like, and this is a quote, it basically looked like the shark had launched itself out of the water, close quote. And I think this is important because when you look at all of the photographs, as I have, that the Pelagic Shark Research Foundation has sent me, they are so many of them are like way up on top of shells, on top of rocks, far away. You can see water in the background. And one of the questions is, how in the world are these leopard sharks getting out of the water so far inland that just we're not talking like being in the ocean, you know, where a big ocean rises and falls. There's definitely ocean tides, but this is the inland bay at Redwood City and Foster City. That's sort of a peculiar part of this. And then at Stanford University, the Hopkins Marine Station in Pacific Grove, they have suggested something that's very interesting but still unproven. There was tremendous amounts of rain in the San Francisco area this spring. And they know that the leopard shark likes or prefers salty water. Mm-hmm. But it is such a strong animal that, as Sean said, it is known to survive a wide range of all kinds of conditions because it is so strong. But Stanford is now looking at the possibility that the water, the rain, may have changed the salinity so much that it's hurting the sharks. And they put some sensors in some parts of San Francisco Bay to record salinity levels. And they found that in their lab research, and then when they went out into the bay, that they found some of the salinity had dropped down to levels that were very low, and that it becomes harder for sharks to compensate for a very low salinity. Is that related to any of this? No one knows. Well, when you just boil it all down, whatever the root of the problem, as Sean himself has said, he thinks that so far that he and the California Fish and Game have only really touched the tip of the iceberg on this story in terms of the number of animal reports that they have gotten from the public. And he really urges people to call if you're living anywhere in that area, you see a dead animal, don't try to handle it yourself. Call the Pelagic Shark Foundation or call the California Fish and Game Office. And he said, stressing how abnormal all this is, quote, we found 50 sharks in one canal in Redwood City alone, and now it has spread to phone calls coming from Millbrae and Sausalito and Mill Valley. And it is as if the area, the geographic area, has expanded starting in Redwood City to Foster City. Jeez. And going north and spreading. And that is a mystery in and of itself.
Sounds like the planet's dying, Linda, doesn't it?
Well, I sure want to be able to report, I hope, on the next coast, at least some laboratory analysis answer to these leopard sharks, these wonderful creatures that should not be dying out in San Francisco Bay.
Next up, when we come back with Linda Moulton Howe, non-human beam technology, what is that all about? Followed by the final hour, conversations with Linda right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, for you whistleblowers or those of you who have questions for Linda Moulton Howe, we'll take your calls. And when we come back, we'll talk about this non-human beam technology, whatever that could be, next on Coast to Coast AM. And talk about stories of high strangeness, Linda. This next one is weird.
This is one of the most interesting and I think most important cases that I've ever worked on in my professional career. And it involves a beam technology. You've heard them described in a number of human abduction cases over the last 30, 40 years. These beams that people describe as white or blue or red, mm-hmm. or orange or green. And what we're going to be talking about tonight is a very specific cerulean blue. And these beams are described by eyewitnesses as being able to pick up plants, animals, and humans, and even pick up a moving car containing people. One experiencer of such a beam was Jim Sparks, that I've interviewed before, sure, for Earth Files and for Coast to Coast. He says that he was conscious most of the time when a vibration would come in his bedroom at night. He would rise in the air through the ceiling and through the roof, completely consciously, up above his house and into a craft where he was forced to interact with non-human entities and computer-like machines with screens that taught him alien equivalents to Jim's American English alphabet and numbers. That high strangeness began for Jim Sparks in 1986 and lasted for at least 6 years while he worked in North Carolina real estate development. And far west across the country in Colorado, a week before Thanksgiving 1980, a husband and wife that I will call Irene and Gary Thompson to protect their request still for anonymity, they also ran into one of those lifting beams while they were driving on a freeway north of Boulder. At the time, the man was a commercial artist and his wife raised their daughter. Mr. Thompson had previously worked as a United States Air Force launch control officer at missile sites. That comes in interesting in a note that is in the hypnosis transcripts that I'm unfolding in the Real X-Files at Earth Files that is separate from this very special interview tonight for Coast and Earth Files, in which he says that inside of this craft with his wife, that it smells the way he remembered the launch control console to have smelled when he was overseeing missiles in a missile site. With his artist's mind, he told Boulder hypnotherapist Richard Sigismund and me that a cerulean blue light surrounded their car. And then, by the time the couple reached their Longmont home, they realized the clock was 1 hour later than it should have been for that drive home. The couple, who still wants anonymity, agreed that I could call them Gary and Irene Thompson, but for the first time for tonight, for Earth Files and on this Coast to Coast AM, in all these years, they gave me permission finally to talk on an audio recording for the public. And to me, this is very significant. I was there for each hypnosis session over 1981 to 1984, 3 years.
It's a long time.
To photograph and audio record for transcripts. And I have all the original transcripts, George, and they fill 4 inches. This is an extensive, incredible case. And Richard Sigismund and the couple gave me permission to use some excerpts and illustrations in my first book, An Alien Harvest, that I came out in 1989. And now, tonight, for the first time, I am going to be able to share with you some of their memory in 2011 of what happened back in November 1980. And I want all of the Coast listeners to know that they're extensive, those 4 inches of the transcripts of the original hypnosis, I am unfolding in a several-part Real X Files series at earthfiles.com. But tonight, you can go to Earth Files and click on the report of this first interview with who I am calling Gary and Irene Thompson.
And suddenly there was a blue light, cerulean blue light that enveloped the car. We drove into that light, and there was a sound, sounded like a bullwhip going around. Very loud sound, whipped through the air.
Can you make that sound now?
Yeah, it was like a I said, what the heck is going on? And the car electric system seemed to shut off. The lights shut off. The interior lights shut off. And we found ourselves being pulled up into the air. And the front part of the car was like a 30-degree angle lower. And my wife turned around in the seat, grabbed the back of the seat so she wouldn't fall under the dashboard. And we flew through the air. I don't know how far we went, but I know it was cold because it's November in Colorado. There were no leaves on the trees. And wherever it was that this car stopped and landed, it was warmer and there were leaves on the trees. So we went quite a ways. I don't know where we went, but we went someplace warmer. And when we landed, there were what I've now referred to as grays that kind of surrounded the car. They were wearing like gold lame suits. It was a very strange sight. They opened the doors, then we got out of the car. There was a spaceship there. It was a round ship. It had like chancery windows all the way around it. There was a door opened, something like a gangplank was there. And there was a man standing in that ship right in that doorway. He looked like a Caucasian man with a very large forehead.
Did he have any hair, and what was he wearing?
Well, he was bald, and he was wearing like a blue cape kind of a thing with a big collar. The collar stood up. It was a very dressy thing. Whereas the other people that were there, they looked different from him, and they were wearing these skin-tight kind of suits, and he was wearing a fancy coat.
And what color were the tight suits on the smaller grays?
As I recall, they were gold, like a gold lame kind of outfits.
Sparkly?
Yeah, kind of sparkly. The fellow in the blue coat, the big guy, he put his hands out like, welcome. And we walked up the gangplank and went in this ship. When we got in there, there were some other types of people. So there were really three types of little grays. And there was the fellow that looked like a Caucasian human with a big forehead. And then there were some other very skinny kind of people. They had also very large foreheads, very thin, and they had very long fingers. Hands were very strange, very slender.
Who seemed to be in control?
Oh, the man in the blue coat. He was the boss.
Okay.
We were very apprehensive, and suddenly some of these very slender people came and got my wife and started to walk her down into a different part of the ship, like a hallway. And then I went ballistic. I started going after the big guy in the blue coat. Pretty good-sized guy, probably around 6 foot tall. I hadn't been out of the Army that long. And he looked at me, and his eyes, his look, his gaze, was like it created an energy. And he slammed me back up against one of the walls.
Hmm.
A couple of these slender people grabbed a hold of me then and held me there.
Eye color?
I don't recall his eye color, but I do recall that when he gazed, I mean, what I saw was red. Whether his eyes turned red, whether his pupils turned red, I don't know. He created an energy that was immense, and it slammed me back against a wall. And nobody touched me, but I had started out for him. Started running at him. I said, I'm going to kill you. And he just seemed to, like, stiffen up, and then he got this very intense stare and created an energy that was very strong, and it blew me back into a wall.
Did the skinny beings then immediately come and grab you?
Well, I was back against the wall. They were back there already, I guess. They reached out and grabbed a hold of one arm, one on the other.
And were they taller than you?
As I recall, they were pretty close to my size.
And you're how tall?
About 5'9".
So they're a little bit shorter than the bald Caucasian-looking man in the blue cape.
Yes.
And the grays?
Oh, I'd say 3 feet.
So now you have the 5'9", very thin beings on either side of your arms. What happens?
I realized that I had no power there, and they'd taken my life someplace, and I was left there. There was another room that was about 15 or 20 feet away from the entrance. In the middle of that room, there was a light that started to shine in the floor. It was a rectangular light, and that light produced a table. Like a cube. It just came up and it produced like a solid table.
Was there color to that square light?
No, it was pure white, very white light. I ended up with all my clothes off on that table. There was an instrument that was placed over my forehead, and I do know that my right eye was taken out of the socket. This instrument that they placed on my forehead seemed to take all of my thoughts, started right from the present and went backwards. And it was like running a movie backwards. And everything that happened in my life, I recall it being removed from my brain. And I went back to the point where there was nothing there. At that point, they started putting it back in. So what I assumed was that they had somehow recorded everything that was in my brain. There was some sort of a sexual thing where I think they took my semen. I ended up with my clothes back on. My wife came back out. The fellow in the blue coat seemed to bid us goodbye, and we were back in the car. And the next thing I know, we were driving down Highway 119 again.
When Gary and Irene were back on Highway 119 driving home in their station wagon, all they knew was both had seen the puzzling greenish-blue lights around their car, and they got to their Longmont house an hour later than the trip should have taken. Then, within a few days, Irene became so ill she was hospitalized. Doctors confirmed she was pregnant and warned the couple that her very high persistent fever and the raging bacteria or virus in her body could damage the two-month-old fetus. The couple's Catholic faith kept them going with the pregnancy. When labor pains started early, the doctors were concerned that the premature baby would be damaged. So everyone was shocked when Irene delivered a full-grown, large, extremely healthy and bright son, who is now 30 years old and a brilliant professional in the biomedical field. For the first time in audio recording, Irene talked to me recently for my news website, earthfiles.com, and for this Coast radio broadcast.
It's like being kidnapped and raped and a frightening experience. Well, I was on the table. I think they took the baby. I was beside myself. They had him in like a lab room or something like that. They were doing something with the baby.
When you say baby and you were only 2 months pregnant at the time, it's just a very tiny fetus.
Correct.
So what is it that you remember actually seeing these beings in the white suits do that you figured that it was a fetus being taken from you?
I did not really see much of the fetus. They were all around it in like another room. I just remember knowing they had done that. I remember starting to yell obscenities and carrying on and not getting much of a reaction.
Did you know that they had some kind of instrumentation inside of you?
Yes.
And what did you sense was occurring?
Well, since I thought I was pregnant again, I felt that they were maybe aborting my pregnancy.
Did you have some kind of a mental image, perhaps even telepathic communication from these beings, that they were taking this fetus out of your uterus for some reason, and then you became aware that they were all around this fetus?
Yes. I mean, that would be the only way I think that I knew where the fetus was, and I think they were trying to call me.
What would be your very next memory after that?
It was sitting in the room when the guy with the blue cloak had come in.
You're very angry?
Yeah.
Are you screaming at him?
Yes, and I'm telling him, you have no right to take people this way. You have no right to trick them this way. And I remember him saying something like, to make an excuse, yes, maybe you're right, but sometimes the means justify the end.
The means justifying the end. What could they have been doing?
I think we were picked, and I think we were tagged, and I think that's what they did to the fetus.
And when you say tagged, what do you mean?
That I think they put something they could track us with.
The tracking would be for what purpose?
I'm thinking maybe genetic changes on people.
Coming back to the taller, blue-caped humanoid.
What I could remember later was him coming to me after my examination and my wanting to tear his face off. I was so frightened and angry. And I was coming at him with my fingernails, and he seemed to look startled. And he asked if I wanted to go see my husband now. I remember walking across the room. It was a big kind of round room, and there were all these beings on either side of the room bowing to him.
What did that seem to be representing to you?
It's almost like father giving a daughter away. You know, wedding, you know, it was very strange, but showing respect to him
Could this have been his way of apologizing to you for a vaginal invasion, and that he took you as a sort of peer with him through these other beings that acknowledged him and you together?
Well, I'd like to think that.
And George, I ask her this end question because I was sitting there in Richard Sigismund's office 30 years ago when we were working with Maureen. We would work with David first, and then we worked with Maureen, and then we would bring the two back together for comments. And what she has forgotten is that under hypnosis, not the conscious discussion, but under the hypnosis, she said, "Why is he doing this? He's having these beings bow to me." And she sounds angry and insulted. And she says, "Does he think that their bowing to me is going to excuse and take away what they have done to me?" That was under hypnosis 30 years ago. When we did this interview, she is interpreting it as that all the bowing was to him. I still think that her original hypnosis is the one that's correct, that they went through a metaphor. They went through a theatrical production to honor her in her anger, and that is exactly the kind of theatrical metaphor that Jim Sparks has described in his own abduction series, Staying Conscious, that they would do things where he knew it was a theatrical metaphor, like an owl in the air would mean it is time for lessons on the computer with the language. In this case, whatever was the end goal of manipulating the fetus, if they are the ones responsible, they protected the fetus. It was allowed to be born without any harm from whatever the disastrous disease was that took over her. And in the end, it may be that, like so many problems with humans trying to communicate with each other on this planet, that the non-humans and the way their minds and telepathy work, that one of the biggest difficulties is communicating to humans so that humans can even understand what might be a multiple-layered agenda that might have to do with preserving life, not hurting life.
Up next, conversations with Linda Moulton Howe, whistleblowers. Of course, we get a lot of stories that way, or just questions for her, next on Coast to Coast AM.